and welcome back to Power Suit Podcast, the 1980s branded podcast where we talk to incredible creative leaders about where the hell the creative industries are going and how we can stay employable while it's changing so fast. I'm your host Lauren and the founder of Power Suit Social, a creative network for unpredictable times. Today I'm speaking to Nishma Robb, who is Ads Marketing Director at Google and is basically one of the most badass women in the communications and tech worlds. She started her career at Teletext, if you remember it. Obviously, I love the retro aesthetic and any kind of defunct technology because there's something kind of magical about that. Nishma then moved up the ranks to become managing director of their travel division and then later heading up marketing a new business for a performance agency called iProspect. She's now been at Google for 4 years and has won numerous accolades, including recently being named on the 20 Outstanding Women to Watch by Ad Age magazine this year, which is huge in the advertising industry, and she was also in this year's Power 100 from Campaign magazine. Nishma's been an incredible advocate for women in the industry and for wider diversity, but I want to hear about Nishma's career, her advice, and where she sees things going. Really honoured to have you join, Nishma. Welcome.
Thank you. Very delighted to be here, actually. I feel honoured to be here with that intro and just to be here talking to you.
Oh, good. Thank you. So I always really love to hear about how people have got to where they are. I know you've been at Google for about 4 years now, but how did you first start out? What was your first job?
When I was young, I'm going to go that far back, I lived in an analogue world, obviously, at that time. And I was obsessed with magazines, absolutely loved glossy magazines and fashion and advertising, although whether that registered with me, that's what it was. But I loved the way that stories were told, you know, both through words and through images. And I kind of set my heart on wanting to be a storyteller of some kind. And I think at that point, it was really to be a journalist. And I remember writing hundreds of letters one summer, because it was kind of, as I said, pre-computers and emails, writing hundreds of letters to all these magazines, kind of begging for an opportunity to come in and do an apprenticeship or an internship or something. And after kind of repeatedly doing that one summer, I eventually got a yes back from Marie Claire magazine, which at the time was really, I suppose, it was the pinnacle of women's magazines. It was seen as not just a great kind of fashion bible as such, but also it was really leading kind of features editorial for women. And I was very lucky to work as a researcher, summer internship as a researcher for the features team for a wonderful lady called Michelle Lavery. Went in and thought this was a dream job. And I spent the summer mainly hidden away in the IPC libraries, reading magazines, which initially at the start of the summer seemed rather wonderful. And by several weeks in, was rather lonely and a little bit dark in there. And what I discovered at that summer is I still loved that sense of storytelling, but I didn't necessarily have what it took to be a journalist, which was quite tough, actually, because I think when you've always kind of dreamt as being one thing and then all of a sudden actually you hit that realisation to go, oh, I'm not actually that good at it and I'm not sure it's quite what I want to do. That's probably what really tipped me into thinking about advertising and marketing. But really at that point, I went on to finish my degree and came out at the other end, realised I was at the height of the recession and was keen for a job. And I, after a very short stint at Haymarket, ended up at Teletext in actually a sales role. I don't think I even had Teletext on my telly at home. So it was a really bizarre situation where I'd kind of heard about it, didn't really know much about it. But anyway, went into kind of a sales role, but in a media sense. So it was kind of touching advertising. It touched technology, which I loved and had realised my kind of inner passion for kind of geek and technology. And really my career kind of evolved in always media and advertising and then deeper into creative, as to the point that I'm at now, where I suppose I have that perfect intersection of creativity, media, technology and advertising. So a bit of a kind of funny journey. I'm not sure that I would have planned it out quite as I did. But I definitely think all the experiences that I gained along the way helped me refine my strengths and my weaknesses, and certainly what I was passionate about and had the ability to do and deliver. And I probably feel that I'm in the best role at the moment or best opportunity of scope of work and creativity that I could possibly be in.
Yeah, a sort of good marriage of what you're interested in. I was really intrigued by your stint at Teletext, partly because I say I like the retro aesthetic, but obviously that was an important precursor to how we use the internet at the moment. So you say you were in sales there. How did you end up in that and what were you actually doing?
Funny enough, I loved the aesthetic. I loved all that retro aesthetic. I did someone say to me the other day, are you just drawn to kind of bright primary colours, where they were Teletext or Google? Teletext only had 9 colours, to be fair, and little Lego brick graphics. So when I joined there, I joined in the advertising sales team. So Teletext was a public service broadcaster, but it actually was funded from advertising revenues. And although it had a license to create editorial content, It was funded through the advertising revenues we made. And the key investors in there were the Daily Mail Group and Philips, who owned the technology of the chips. And I was there. I went in, as I said, initially in a sales role to help sell these little adverts or the pages of ads that you would see so that the holidays that people would kind of tune into and watch pages and pages of these adverts kind of flicking by to often kind of late sale holidays. And I was working with the agencies, so working with media agencies and working with clients to sell the medium. But it was a really unknown medium because, as you say, actually it was the internet before the internet. So if you think about consumer behaviour, it was fascinating to think about. And I still used to be amazed that I would speak to the clients and they'd tell me about these hundreds of phone calls that they would get every day for people phoning up for these holidays, which was kind of the main mechanic of engaging with the ads. But really, when we thought about it, what would happen is this was being beamed out behind ITV and Channel 4. There was no other way at that point where consumers, where people had access to information at their fingertips. And yet Teletext offered that, as did CFAX. And you'd press a button, and you'd launch into the service, and you would navigate your way through this set of page numbers, three-digit page numbers that would, you know, take you around the service. And it's incredible to think about because it was really the kind of most basic Google of its time, but it definitely shaped behaviour. And I think when we think about the UK is a very sophisticated digital market. We are a big e-commerce market in the UK. And I'd like to think that services like Teletext really shaped some of that behaviour. You know, we really gave birth to the model of pay per performance advertising. You know, often you could pay per the phone call, etc., and just as pay-per-click then went to evolve. But I think it shaped consumer behaviour about access to information as readily as it possibly could. You know, people would check football results, the weather, something happened, the news. It was your instant way. In the days before 24-hour news channels and the internet, it was how you checked things. But it also shaped the way advertising worked. So in terms of performance advertising, it was a really smart, and I'd say kind of probably the first really kind of route into that kind of performance advertising. So I went in a sales role, progressed through the ranks in the various sales jobs, so selling the advertising medium, then evolving that platform onto digital. We could see the internet had been born at that point and was very, very rapidly growing in terms of its use and access and its value to businesses. And there was a license thing, you know, a little bit like the licenses that were sold off for 3G. We knew that at some point the analog service would be switched off. So there was an end point to the business. So we very rapidly needed to evolve it into a digital business. And I worked very closely and kind of led some of those teams first into our foray into digital TV. So the services that now exist, I suppose, behind like what we call the red button, and also developed the first website. So I loved the fact that I was definitely one of the people who kind of lived that analog and digital world and was also one of the people who really helped transform a business from an analog into a digital world.
Really cool. Actually, just for benefit of listeners, would you mind giving a sentence as to how you define sort of performance marketing?
Yeah, and performance marketing for me is really marketing that's really driving and delivering an action. So on Teletext, it was pages of adverts that would have a specific holiday or price or an action that people would pick up the phone to be able to act upon it. At Google, it's probably what most commonly people are familiar with the ads. So when you do a Google search, the advertising or the listings that appear at the top or on the right-hand side are ads that you can then click on and act with. And that effectively creates a performance metric, whether it's a phone call, a click, a purchase, a buy. And that's really what's performance marketing rather than brand marketing, which doesn't necessarily drive an immediate action, but is giving you a sense of awareness and understanding of the product.
Cool, thank you. So moving on to your time at Google, how did you end up there and what does ads marketing director actually mean? What does your job entail?
So I've been a customer of Google right from the beginning in some respects. So my role at Teletext, as well as I had the sales role, as I moved up into the leadership of the business, I took on the responsibility of marketing. And at that time, as I said, we were building our website there, and Google was a key part. It was a competitor, but also as a marketing leader, it was another route to market. So we were advertising on Google to pull traffic into the Teletext website. So I had that very funny role of on the one hand competing with them, on the other hand being a customer of them. So I'd always tracked Google's entry into the UK market and its development as a service, both as a customer, loved it. You know, I always think about the fact of all the things that the internet and search gave me. Search gave me the opportunity to shop after hours because I worked far too many hours, but I could still buy my shoes from the wonderful sites that were being set up, whether Net-a-Porter or in the very early days of ASOS when it was a scene on screen.
I remember that.
Yeah, and I loved it. And I think, gosh, you know, what did the internet, what did search give me? Search gave me all this opportunity. And from a business point of view, it helped us. It was, you know, it was a significant and growing channel. So I'd always been very familiar with Google and its practices and had admired really the business. And it's funny, actually, Google search is 20 years old this year, later this year. And it's had me thinking a lot about, my goodness, life without it, but also that journey in 20 years, both as a consumer, as a professional, as a marketeer, etc. You know, it's really interesting to think about it. So anyway, as a partner of it, I had moved from Teletext, then I went off to work in a media agency, a very small one initially called iSpy, and then later at Dentsu. And again, we were really, I suppose, you know, one of the key partners of Google for the, we were buying ads from them. So I'd been very familiar with the business, very familiar with what they were trying to achieve and passionate about what they liked. So through my interactions with them, I had the opportunity to take this role as the ads marketing director, which effectively what it was, this is a marketing role where I'm telling the stories and shaping our presence, our reputation, our relationships with the advertising industry. So both agencies and clients, and perhaps obviously more than that, publishers as well, of how Google really kind of engages with them. So it's marketing our solutions to businesses to help them grow and thinking about all the very smart ways that we need to continue to innovate and accelerate what's happening, whether it's technology, whether it's the political and economic landscape, whether it's actually the way that consumers are changing at actually sometimes a faster pace. How does Google really help businesses continue to grow? And I felt, I mean, for me, it was a really natural role to go in. So having been media owner, I'd done a stint client side, I'd then been an agency. I totally understood the ecosystem and the needs of the people, of the customers, in terms of what Google could deliver. And I was highly critical of some of the things that Google did and also highly admired some of the things they did. And actually, I would say the role I do today is very different probably to the one that was on paper when I first joined, which was probably a more traditional B2B marketing role. Whereas the reality is there's so much convergence in every aspect of life. And the reality is our professionals are as much consumers as they are professionals. And I think the way that we talk and communicate with our customers, businesses, is also remembering that they are consumers first. And therefore, the way that we tell our stories, the way that we use different methods of marketing I've really evolved in the 4 years I've been at Google to really help not just be a better storyteller of our products, but also embrace the community that we're in. You know, Google are a big part of the advertising community, both agencies and clients, in the role that we play from as a business, as a partner, in the services we provide. And I think being really engaged in what that means is something I think I've really brought to the business.
Yeah. So am I right in thinking that you worked on that YouTube campaign, outdoor advertising? Was it encouraging creative or encouraging advertisers?
Well, it was both. So the work that we've done, say, sort of more traditional B2B marketing is often usually kind of very events-based, often kind of DR or DM type pieces, you know, so direct mail, direct kind of content pieces and events. Again, thinking about individuals, whether you're somebody who works in an agency or you're a marketeer, and you now have a plethora of choices of media, far more than when I was trying to sell Teletext, which is probably up against kind of TV, radio and press in its most simplistic terms, obviously outdoor. Now there are so many choices, it's far more complex. So therefore, yes, Google and YouTube are very well known, but we really need to make sure people understand what can be achieved and why and the value and the effectiveness it can bring. So last year, in addition to the events and content, it was really stitching it together with a campaign and an idea of what does YouTube advertising really mean? And I think one of the most important things is make sure people understand what the platform is. And I think in a rather complex world where debate and discussion around what is a value of a click or a view or a like or an individual, etc. Actually, one of the most essential things around this very broad and wonderful platform that's YouTube, that has everything from high production content, content from broadcasters, you know, so there's a whole suite of like content there from, say, for example, Game of Thrones, or ITV and BBC both invest and put a lot of their content on the platform, through to, you know, bedroom stars and generated content from individuals, so user-generated content. So there's a real breadth of content. And the idea is actually people have their own very personal YouTube. I always think people go to it for all sorts of reasons. That's the joy of it, you know, so you can go in to learn something, or you're there to watch and absorb something because you're passionate about a topic or a show or a star. Or you're there perhaps maybe on a slightly more serendipitous journey where you're kind of letting it take you. Music obviously being a huge sector part of that as well, what people watch. But it's very personal. But the one thing that differentiates YouTube and the way that people view it and what they do is this concept of being more than just viewers. And whether that's the idea of more than just viewers because of the way that they interact and act afterwards. So there is a case of I watch something, I make something, I watch something, I might buy something, or I'm inspired, etc. But sometimes there is also a case of more than just viewers because the way that we seek out and engage and watch more of different types of content and passions. So in understanding that relationship of more than just viewers, this idea that people are really tuned in, because I think there's still only 24 hours a day, although I love the fact that we all stretch that. We, in theory, still sleep for approximately the same amount of time, but the rest of our time is really, really stretched and we're all incredibly distracted. So the idea that when someone is watching YouTube is the fact that they do tune in. Often we talk about if they're watching on a phone, it goes from portrait to landscape and they focus in and they zoom in for however long it is that they're watching. That attention is a really valuable commodity from an advertising point of view. So the campaign was there to really help tell that story and show how YouTube is watching all different ways. You know, we had someone who was in the bath, we had, you know, dad trying to change a nappy, we had a lady trying to do her gardening, etc. Kind of that was our first phase of our campaign, and it told the story about how viewers are watching and engaging with content. And from an advertiser's point of view, as a marketeer, you want to think about putting your brand in front of people who are engaged with the right content that's going to deliver the action for you. So that's just a kind of a first phase of a story that was then also, we bring it to life through a wonderful event we had last year called Brandcast, which we have each year, and through other content pieces. Earlier this year, we have it's only in its second year, YouTube Works, which is our advertising recognition plan, award scheme, I suppose, for effectiveness that we do with the APG, which is the Account Planning Group. And that was brilliant. I mean, the campaigns that came through that were amazing and all different things that people measure. So Tesco, there was Smart Energy, there was a great one for this drinks brand, really small campaign, but the impact it had through really creative storytelling and creative way of using YouTube had delivered great impact. And I love that. We always talk about this at Google. We create great technology and the platforms for people to do wonderful work on. So we build it. We build these platforms and technology and tools. But really, the magic happens is when you put it in the hands of others, whether that's the user or an advertiser or a creative. And that's what gets us really excited, because it's that magic that we love getting, you know, sharing and telling people about.
That's really cool. What's the working culture like at Google? Because obviously we hear a lot as the general public, but I'm interested to know what your impression is.
So, and I'm going to compare it to lots of other places that I've worked. So I think the things that people hear about and read about, you know, all the wonderful food, which there's sometimes just far too much of, and it's wonderful, we really are very spoiled. But the environment, so the beautiful offices, the wonderful field, the services that are in there, the gyms, the massages, etc., of course it's wonderful. And all of that is about employee happiness, but it's also about fostering this behaviour of collaboration. So the fact that you'll be in a queue getting your lunch in the restaurant, and you may come across somebody you've never met before, and the striking up of conversations. It's kind of school benches in terms of tables, so it kind of pushes you into talking to people. Those serendipitous moments of meeting someone have led to great things. And initially, I think I was probably a little bit cynical about this when I heard all this, but I can say I've definitely been a product of those conversations that of people I've met I perhaps wouldn't have done otherwise. So the environment and the space is designed very cleverly, both for happiness, but also to foster this innovative, collaborative behaviour in amongst us. It's a fast pace. It's a complex business. I think those are things that perhaps people might see, they may not see, which, you know, definitely has its challenges. But I think one of the most incredible things, the level of trust in the organisation from the day you join is incredible. So the amount of information that's shared with you and respecting you as an individual and the input you can bring, but also what that leads to, particularly in a creative role, is it means that your thinking is unguided in some respects, in a wonderful way. So there are no barriers and limitations and restrictions, which is why I think great ideas kind of get to develop and evolve. And it can come from anywhere. The hierarchy is minimal. It's where it's necessary and it doesn't get in the way. But actually, I think that idea that there is this really wonderful kind of democratic approach to people being able to kind of pitch in and help. It's a great culture. You know, people genuinely really like, I mean, I always say, gosh, I turn up to meetings and everyone's so incredibly bright. In a wonderful way, though, you know, in a really kind of positive, you get great energy out of the meetings you get and wonderful ideas from individuals and a real sense of helping each other and making it happen. I think the greater challenge at Google is we always have too much to do or too much we'd love to do and lots of eager people who want to do it. And our greatest challenge is the priorities and being able to choose the right things to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. Moving away from Google for a minute, you've also got a lot of involvement in kind of extracurricular things, I guess a bit like I have or have done. So you've been board director and fellow of the Marketing Society, and you were the chair of Women at Google. You also set up Women at iProspect. Do you think all of that kind of extracurricular bits and bobs, do you think they've helped propel your career forward?
Definitely, there's no doubt about it. It's a really difficult one, but and I see people do it more and more, and I think actually the extracurricular things you do evolve over time. So for me, the Women at staff, both at iProspect and at Google, were real passion points for me, and it perhaps was a later awakening for me post having my children, but recognising the bias that existed and the challenge. And I kind of got fed up of just looking around the room and not seeing enough women, or actually it's still a challenge of people of a broader set of diversity as well. So I had got frustrated, and I think a little bit like you, and that's why I loved your story about why you set up PowerSuit Podcast and all the work that you're doing, PowerSuit Social. I think it's that sense of, rather than just being frustrated, is saying, actually, do you know, I can do something about this and I'm going to take action, and it's not going to be easy and it's going to take quite a long time to deliver, but I'm going to lean into it and really make it happen. And those passions are important. I might call it my soul food. It's the stuff that really makes me feel great about life. But in the other sense, it's opened up networks and people and opportunities I don't think I would have had otherwise. You can kind of stick in your lane and do your job and be brilliant at it, and it will open up more and more doors. You can also step aside to things that you really care very passionate about. It perhaps pushes you into areas of skills and circles that you're perhaps not as familiar with, and that's a great challenge to your own development. It really broadens your experience. You get to try things you wouldn't do. The Marketing Society board director, it's a real rock star board of individuals, so you're constantly learning from those around you. But again, it's an opportunity to be an architect in whether it's society or the Women at Work I do, or diversity more broadly, of we are in a really amazing time. I always think, had I been alive maybe at the Industrial Revolution, I might have felt the same way then. We're the generation that are very fortunate to be in a position where a lot of the actions and the decisions we make will change for the next generation and generations beyond. Maybe the way that we work, or the way that we view talent, or how we build diverse teams. And for me, that really energises me to be part of that. And so whether it's diversity from a talent point of view, or the Marketing Society and its agenda of bravery and bravery of leadership, that's core, because actually building and developing great, brave leaders will lead to brave work, great advertising, great stories, really kind of changes people's perceptions and minds. And that has the opportunity to have a lasting legacy.
Mm. What do you think your next big thing might be, a next project?
My next side shuffle. What's my next side gig? I did Women at Google for a couple of years, loved it, very passionate. And as I say, it was a huge step into, I suppose, a broader conversation, etc. You do it for a term and then you move on. But one of the things towards the end of that, I really felt very strongly about, actually, it's about inclusivity rather than diversity tick boxing, which is what I see far too often. And the way we need to get there is to build inclusive teams. And that's thinking about race. It's thinking about class. It's thinking about ability. I think at the moment, the gender issue has been a Trojan horse, so long as we use it in that way and we open up conversation. The challenge is it's almost a little bit too easy to say, well, we'll do this first and we'll address everything else afterwards. So I think the thing that I'm probably most restless about at the moment is, how do I create more attention, particularly around class and race and disability, because we live in London, work in London, one of the most amazing city in the world, I still stand by. And it is, the reason why it's a wonderful city is because of the diversity, because of the different types of people and abilities, and that mix is what makes this country fantastic and this city brilliant. And I think at the moment that's not reflected in businesses and it's not reflected in work. And for me, that's probably the area that I feel most passionate about. That and the development of creative and the arts piece. You know, I think there's a lot of areas of fear, both whether it's about diverse talent or whether it's about the development of kind of creativity in arts, where technology or other reasons could be seen to be a threat, whereas actually these are just back then, like in the Industrial Revolution I look at now, this is an opportunity. And we are the people who can really look at how these things will come together and develop.
Mm. So in terms of people staying employable while things are changing as much as this, I know you've worked on agency side and client side, and now you're at one of the biggest tech giants. People are probably wondering which of those might feel like a safe bet at the moment. Do you think having quite a broad CV is the safest way of doing things?
So safe is an interesting thing, because I suppose it's safety in the sense of there is so much disruption and change in the world and the industry that we work in, that it can feel as though it's better to kind of go with a safer option. I think my challenge to that would be that the experience and kind of the richness you get out of the jobs you do and the things, you know, to land a place where you get to the thing you most want to do, you need experience. Now, that can be through an agency route. It could be through a client route. You know, I always encourage people to look at, try your hand at both. It's really important to experience both sides of the fence. And a media owner or a tech company like ourselves. I think safety is more around the way a business will look after you and enrich your experience and the skills that you pick up, which you have to drive. You are in charge of your own destiny. You have to lean in and find the experiences, pick up the skills. And of course, great employers and great cultures help that happen more easily. But you are very much in the driving seat of this. And whenever I talk to any of our staff or some of the people that I mentor, I always talk about, think about the skills you want to pick up and put in your bag. I always kind of remember you've got this bag that you carry on with you, and all the experiences that you can get is really what will enrich you to get to ultimate happiness, I suppose. And you should be happy all the way through, but to find the role. Safety is really, for me, is equal to happiness. You know, if you're happy then and secure and you can do that, actually the company that you're in doesn't necessarily drive that. I think you do. And so for me, experience of trying different things, different cultures, different teams of people, different ways of working, that on a CV or you're in your mind or how you present yourself to gain the opportunities you want is more attractive than anything else. I'm less bothered about how someone moved from here, there and everywhere. I really look at him and say, what have you done? And that's the extracurricular stuff as well as your day job. People who explore passions, and it takes some bravery because you're going to find a whole load of stuff you don't really like or you're not very good at, as I said, as I started in my career. But that helps because I think then you're far more certain and lean into the strengths you have. And that makes people really attractive. You know, the stories that someone can tell you about the things they've done and the things they've learned and what they've experienced. And it's not just like a list of huge level of achievements. Actually, I'm always fascinated by people's failures, much more so than their achievements. Because the reality is we usually learn more from our failures. And or certainly the ones that I think continue to develop very well are the ones that learn from failure. So when I'm seeing people certainly looking for talent, I'm really interested in that. I kind of really dig into what's not gone well. Why didn't it go well? What would you do differently? What are the experiences? Where have you tested yourself? Versus the kind of traditional, you know, I feel slightly frustrated that recruitment is still very much around a 2-page CV of achievements. And I'm not quite sure that's the way the world works now, because in a time of change and instability or security, the ability to be agile, the ability to be work and be comfortable with ambiguity are really important skills. And that agility, that resilience and being comfortable around change and opportunity really come from a richness of experience.
Do you think there's something better than a CV, or is it more about just that ability to...
Yeah, do you know, I love people to... The CVs is a factual kind of digest of things, but it doesn't necessarily tell a great story about an individual. And I look at the resources you have available to anyone now to help tell their own story. I love it when people are more creative about them there. Can you really sell yourself with a 2-page CV? I'm not sure I could. But I think there's ways of something very individual about how you tell that story.
Yeah, that's
true. And yes, you need the factual information, but can you do that alongside it, particularly in creative roles? You know, if you want to go for a creative role, be creative, tell... It is about storytelling, ultimately. It is about how you present and communicate your value, your worth, your contribution. And I always thought, I love people who come and say to me, I think this is what I could do for you. Having gone away and thought about, actually, this is where I think maybe your challenge is, I saw what you could do. This is what I could do for you, versus sometimes people saying, well, these are all things I can do. What can you do for me? And it's like, how does that change?
Yeah.
I think the other thing I would say in terms of being employable, there are wonderful services like the Dots and other networks. I don't like the term networking. I feel it sounds so contrived. And I don't think I've ever in my life thought I've gone, oh, I'm going out networking. I would say I'm going out to meet people. And it's, you know, whether you're going down the pub or wherever it might be, your natural curiosity and asking more questions, not in an annoying way, but in a way that I think demonstrates your curiosity, because it should be kind of natural and honest, is where you're listening. So you learn so much more. And often in life, we spend so much talking time. We're like talking. We don't listen enough. So CVs are one thing, experience is another. But actually, the people you meet, life hasn't changed that much. It's still a lot about who do you meet, what do you learn from them, and how do you use that smartly?
Mm. Well, that's what's been really beneficial about this podcast, is just kind of, I just approach my like creative heroes and say, can I talk to you?
But also, I think that there is that willingness people do want to talk. That's when I always think that, thankfully, I don't believe that the art of conversation has died, although sometimes I do read things that suggest otherwise. we are humans, and human connection is really important, and humanity and respect and listening to each other. And we just need to do more of that. And I'm often accused by my friends and those close to me that I do talk a lot and I like to chat. But I ask lots of questions. I don't just talk.
I'm not a brilliant question asker, but that's...
doing brilliantly.
I've got the questions in front of me. Oh, good. Yeah. So I always make my interviewees answer this about where things are going. So yeah, back in the late 80s, we'd hauled ourselves out of this recession. And yeah, I personally believe it's thanks to shoulder pads and power suits, all that sort of thing. But where do you think things could be in about 30 years from now?
Wow, 30 years from now. So it'd be, what, 2048? I know, isn't that terrifying to think about? I was thinking, gosh, I'll be really old by then. I love that idea. I love your phrasing here, because I distinctly remember the late 80s. I hadn't quite started my career yet, but I was definitely mesmerised by the film and the visuals that really did paint that picture of, as you say, marvellous shoulder pads. I think I might still wear them every now and then, but marvellous shoulder pads and a lot of hairspray and this kind of impatience around progress and creativity, and really kind of, I think there was a lot of bravery around then, if I think back, even just advertising. I think 30 years from now, as I said, you know, often there can be fear around how technology will change our lives. I would like to believe that what we will see is technology really kind of enabling and assisting the way that we tell stories, but a much smarter and deeper level of connection than we've ever had before. Because actually, if you look at humanity and the development and how we connect and engage with individuals, the world has become smaller. We have a better understanding, maybe not always a good enough appreciation, but we have a better understanding of what's happening in our entire world. And I think rather than this idea that we retreat, I actually think that this will flourish, because the melting pot of people who cross boundaries, fall in love, where it becomes harder to kind of track back to roots and have tribes and conflict. You know, I know this is kind of a very idealistic view, but this idea that actually our connections with each other go far beyond, you know, the what we can see and what we term and label ourselves, but goes to this really kind of beautiful place about how we engage with each other. I think creativity, I hope and believe, I've got to hope and believe, because I think it'd be terribly sad or not, that we will really, businesses and teams and work will absolutely genuinely reflect the diversity of the world that we live in. And we won't have this terrible situation where media and advertising and books and film, etc., videos do not reflect the reality of most people as they live. And, you know, I get on the tube or I look around London and I don't see it reflected sufficiently. So I hope in 30 years that will be done. We won't be talking about that anymore. We won't be talking about robots taking our job. We'll be talking about this wonderful, deeper sense of connection and way that we tell stories. I think that we'll be hopefully more heightened senses about how we engage. And I just hope more than anything else that we're more responsible, that we are, because we're less kind of fretting over the small stuff, that we can think about the big stuff, and that we're being more responsible about the world that we live in and for the future generations and each other. My God, it's such a romantic ideal view, isn't it? It's probably not going to be like that at all. We'll probably still be arguing about Brexit, more than likely.
Well, I hope you're wrong about the Brexit part.
Yes, so do I.
But I hope you're right about the rest of it. Oh, cool. Well, lastly, where can people find you, Nishma?
So you can always find me on Twitter. I'm on Nishma Rob. I don't tweet lots, but you do get a sense of what I'm tweeting about. We'll either be very passionate about a story or something I'm trying to share. So Nishma Rob is my handle at Twitter. And Instagram. I love Instagram. It's simple. I'm a visual person, therefore I love it. And I'm Nishy Nosh, at Nishy Nosh on Instagram. They're probably the best two. LinkedIn, of course, as well, from a slightly more business perspective. But yeah, seek me out. Share your ideas. Tell me your stories.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Nishma. I've really enjoyed today, and thank you for joining PowerSuit Podcast.
Oh, thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to give us a rating on iTunes so more people can find PowerSuit Podcast. Or if you have any feedback, just tweet us at PowerSuit Social. Thank you for listening.